Coming up, with a decision from the Supreme Court in the Hobby Lobby case expected Monday, Tim O'Brien on what's at stake. Also, Lucky Severson on how some employees in big companies justify unethical behavior. And Kim Lawton on what some call the Christian Woodstock, the annual Wild Goose Festival.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics Newsweekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. And by these funders.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously struck down a Massachusetts law banning protests near clinics that perform abortions. The state's buffer zone law had required that anti-abortion protests take place at least 35 feet from the entrances of clinics. Anti-abortion groups welcomed the ruling as a victory for free speech, but pro-choice advocates, such as the National Council of Jewish Women, said the ruling would put women at risk of being harassed. Meanwhile, the court's long-awaited decision in the Hobby Lobby case is expected Monday. Many court watchers say it's the most important religious case in years. At issue is whether, under the Affordable Care Act, for-profit companies can be required to do something their owners say their religious beliefs forbid. Tim O'Brien reports.
The case was brought by Hobby Lobby, a national chain of craft stores owned by a devoutly Christian family. The family objects to provisions in the Affordable Care Act that require them to provide insurance coverage for contraception methods that they view as tantamount to abortion, such as the morning after pill.
This is an issue of life, that we cannot be a part of taking life. And so to be in a situation where our government is telling us that we have to be is incredible.
Hobby Lobby relies heavily on the 1993 law called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, landmark legislation that states the federal government shall not substantially burden a person's exercise of religion unless it is the least restrictive means of furthering a compelling government interest. The court is expected to use the Hobby Lobby case to determine just how much religious freedom the law actually restores and for whom.
We'll hear argument this morning in consolidated cases, number 13.
When the case was argued last March, the court's more conservative justices appeared supportive of Hobby Lobby, but others questioned whether corporations, like Hobby Lobby, have any religious freedom at all.
How does a corporation exercise religion? Where are the cases that show that a corporation exercises religion?
Justice Anthony Kennedy, often the swing vote in close cases, asked about the religious beliefs of the employees who may not share the beliefs of the employers.
And the employee may not agree with these religious beliefs of the employer. Does the religious beliefs just trump? Is that the way it works?
The court's only female justices, Ruth Ginsburg, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan, seem most skeptical of Hobby Lobby's religious arguments.
But Congress has made a judgment, and Congress has given a statutory entitlement, and that entitlement is to women and includes contraceptive coverage. And when the employer says, no, I don't want to give that, that woman is quite directly, quite tangibly harmed.
At the heart of the case, just how far does the Religious Freedom Restoration Act reach?
Is your claim limited to sensitive materials like contraceptives, or does it include items like blood transfusion, vaccines?
There are many people who have religious objections to vaccinations. What happens then? So another employer comes in, and that employer says, I have a religious objection to sex discrimination laws. And then another employer comes in, I have a religious objection to minimum wage laws. And then another, family leave. And then another, child labor laws.
Not specifically mentioned in the court's arguments, but very much on the line in this case, gay rights. While many cities prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation, accommodating gays and lesbians may violate the religious convictions of some employers and landlords. What happens then?
When Congress passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, it explained that courts were to strike what it called a sensible balance between claims for religious liberty and the interests of government. A sensible balance. Easier said than done, as Monday's decision in this divisive case is all but certain to demonstrate. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Tim O'Brien at the Supreme Court.
A United Methodist pastor who was defrocked for officiating at the same-sex wedding of his son was reinstated this week. Reverend Frank Schaefer of Lebanon, Pennsylvania, was stripped of his credentials last year after he was found guilty by a church court of violating the denomination's ban on clergy conducting same-sex weddings. This week, an appeals panel overturned that ruling, saying the penalty was too severe. The decision has inflamed an already contentious debate in the United Methodist Church over same-sex marriage, with some saying the church could split over the issue. A prominent Mormon activist urging the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to open the priesthood to women has been excommunicated on charges of apostasy. Kate Kelly founded the group Ordain Women in 2013. This week she was informed of her excommunication by email. The email said she could be considered for readmission if she ceases her activism. Kelly said the church's decision was painful, but she stands by her actions. An Episcopal chaplain became the first openly transgender priest to preach at the Washington National Cathedral this week. Reverend Cameron Partridge was at the National Cathedral to speak in honor of LGBT Pride Month. Partridge began transitioning from female to male over a decade ago and is a chaplain at Boston University. In Sudan, Miriam Ibrahim, a Christian woman on death row for refusing to renounce her faith, was freed from prison Monday after an appeals court threw out her apostasy conviction. Ibrahim had been sentenced to be executed after a court ruled that her marriage to Daniel Wani, a U.S. Christian, was invalid. Ibrahim's father was a Muslim, but she was raised in the Christian faith of her mother. In Sudan, children must belong to the religion of their father. Ibrahim gave birth to a daughter in prison, and the couple also has a toddler son. The case generated an international outcry. Ibrahim was briefly detained again Tuesday, along with her family, while trying to leave Sudan. At the end of the week, the family was given refuge in the U.S. Embassy. The humanitarian situation in Iraq continues to deteriorate, with thousands of civilians fleeing spiraling sectarian violence. This week, militants staged an offensive against Christian villages in northern Iraq. According to the United Nations, an estimated 1 million Iraqis have been forced from their homes in the past year. More than 1,000 people have been killed this month. Across all the major religions and ethical traditions, there's broad agreement about how people should behave. Now, researchers with backgrounds in economics and psychology are studying why some people at big companies misbehave. Why do they do things that are unethical? Lucky Severson has our story.
For the past 30 years, Paul Feldman has been making a living getting up long before the sun rises. It's an unlikely livelihood for a Cornell and MIT-educated economist who quit a lucrative Washington research career to deliver bagels. He also delivers donuts, but he's known as the bagel man. His friends were skeptical.
Delivering bagels? You're an economist. You're an executive. You don't do things like that.
Well, he did and still does purchase bagels and donuts from local bakers and then resells them to employees at corporate offices along Washington's Beltway. And he does it on the honor system. In other words, you choose a pastry, you drop what you owe in a box. He'll pick up the proceeds later in the day. Feldman has kept track and says, on average, people are honest 92% of the time.
Honesty is fundamental to the operation of a society like ours. Some people get by being crooks and thieves all the time.
Right.
But most everything that we do, you know, is a matter of honesty.
So are we more or less honest than those before us? Do we cheat more or less? Is it more acceptable? Why is there so much cynicism about government and corporate America, particularly Wall Street?
Wall Street is like a perfect storm of justification. All the things that allow people to justify are in there, and therefore it allows people to think of themselves as good, honorable people while behaving in terribly disgraceful ways.
Dan Ariely is a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University, who has done experiments on honesty and cheating all over the world. And he says cheating unchecked is contagious.
The moment you come to an organization that you feel something is wrong with it, all of a sudden your moral shackles go away. What we find is that when people are thinking about honesty versus dishonesty, they don't do the cost-benefit analysis. They don't say, what do I stand to gain? What do I stand to lose? No, it's all about being able at the moment to rationalize something and make yourself think that this is actually okay. Everybody else is doing this. This is actually the right thing. Things like nobody is really suffering.
There was a survey recently with 250 investment bankers, portfolio managers, traders. The results were not encouraging. One in four said they would trade on inside information if they could get away with it. Over half said their competitors engage in unethical or illegal activities. Listen to this. 24% said they fear retaliation if they report wrongdoing within their company. Bad corporate behavior is nothing new. One of the most infamous incidents occurred in 1970 with the Ford Pinto, which exploded in car crashes because of the location of the gas tank, killing many people. Lee Iacocca was the Ford CEO at the time. And Ten Brunzel is a business professor at Notre Dame.
If we go back to Iacocca, one of the famous quotes that is mentioned frequently is, safety doesn't sell. So if you hear that over and over again, you're a 22-year-old in an organization, it's your first job, suddenly safety just doesn't become part of your criteria.
Professor Ten Brunzel is a director of Notre Dame's Ethical Institute for Business Worldwide and consults with corporations. She believes that despite shareholder pressure, CEOs need to make ethics a fundamental part of the corporate culture and that they need to reward good behavior and not just the bottom line.
If I were a CEO, I'd go down, I'd run focus groups and say, what happened? What are your pressures? Where do you feel the pressure to behave against your values or what you think the values of this organization are? They know.
She says in the long run, companies often pay for unethical behavior. Ford paid for it back then. So did Toyota recently. GM is paying it now.
You look at the amount of kind of damage reputation that occurs in these recalls, right? If you look at the drop in share price, you look at the amount it costs simply to fix the problem, you start to see that it actually can pay to be ethical.
And to attract good workers.
I think if you can rise above the crowd in terms of someone who walks with integrity, someone who lives their values every day, that allows you to really distinguish yourself.
As a trained economist, the 82-year-old bagel man has done some research of his own and says his experience is that employees at larger companies tend to cheat a little more than those at smaller firms. And those who work at companies where ethical conduct is emphasized and morale is high are inclined to be more trustworthy.
I can walk in, people will greet me, they're walking up and down the halls talking to each other, and by and large I think that those places tend to be more responsive and more honest.
Professor Ariely says in his book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, that we all lie a little bit, even God.
There's a story that God comes to Sarah. He says, Sarah, you're going to have a son. And Sarah laughs. And the religious scholars interpreted her laughter as saying, how could I have a son when my husband is so old? I said, don't worry. He goes to Abraham and said, Abraham, you're going to have a son. And Abraham says, did you tell Sarah? God said, yes. And what did Sarah said? And God says, Sarah said, how can I have a son when I am so old? The religious scholars have wondered, how could God lie? How could God misrepresent Sarah? And the conclusion was that it's okay to lie for peace at home.
Professor Ariely is not a religious scholar, but says religion does have an impact on honesty and moral behavior, partly because it offers specific rules connected to a higher order.
And in one experiment, we asked people to try to recall the Ten Commandments. And by the way, we did this in California, and nobody could recall all Ten Commandments, and many of them invented new commandments, which is an interesting topic by itself. But after doing it, they didn't cheat. But in fact, even when we take self-declared atheists and ask them to swear on the Bible, they stop cheating.
Paul LeBago Man says that people are not quite as honest during Christmas and tax time. He's rarely canceled a client company, but he says for some reason he's had a difficult time with telecom companies.
A manager happened to be there one day and said, how are you making out? And I said, well, the people here, they're not paying very well. She said, they'll steal toilet paper in here.
Welcome to the Truth Box. In this project, we're trying to understand the complex relationship we have with honesty and dishonesty.
Professor Ariely travels with the Truth Box and asks volunteers to disclose an important lie they have told in their lives, kind of like a confessional box, which he says helps the confessor behave more morally.
On job interviews, when they ask me about certain skills, I would sometimes say that I had a skill, although I didn't have the skill at the moment.
How often have you told this particular type of lie?
A couple of times, yeah.
And did it work out for you? Did they hire you?
Well, yeah, it did.
So now you've told that lie,
yeah,
publicly. Do you feel better about it?
Well, I'm not going to use it again.
Professor Ten Brunzel is a practicing Catholic and thinks the concept of a confession would be useful to organizations.
If in an organization it's one strike and you're out, what's going to be your likely tendency when you did discover that you did something wrong, perhaps not intending to, perhaps intending to? Your natural tendency is going to be to cover it up. What does that mean for the organization? It gets hidden. Other people might see it and say, well, gosh, if he's doing it, that must be okay. And over the long run, that unethical behavior becomes even more detrimental. So in other words, if I think you're lying to me, it's okay for me to lie to you.
The professor doesn't think the business and finance world is any more or less ethical than in the past, but she is optimistic that things are going to get better, and not only because of the students. She says she is now seeing genuine interest among corporations to reevaluate their values. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Chicago.
Last year, the Gallup poll asked Americans to evaluate the honesty and ethical standards of people in different fields. The highest rankings went to nurses, pharmacists, and grade school teachers. The lowest were car salesmen, members of Congress, and lobbyists. This is the weekend of the annual Wild Goose Festival in rural North Carolina, a successor to the old summer tradition of the camp meeting. The participants are progressive evangelicals and mainline Protestants and others who celebrate their common message of love, justice, and peace. We visited last year's gathering. Kim Lawton has more.
More than 2,000 people make the trek each year to the woods of rural North Carolina for 4 days of camping, community, song, and prayer. Some call it the Christian Woodstock.
Wild Goose is a festival at the intersection of justice, spirituality, music, and art, rooted in the Christian tradition, open to everybody, and mostly focused on learning how to love.
The name Wild Goose comes from the ancient Celtic Christian symbol for the Holy Spirit, and the founders of Wild Goose took their inspiration from other large-scale events, such as the annual Greenbelt Festival held in England for the past 40 years. They felt something similar was needed in the U.S.
I am very frustrated when I hear Jesus' words interpreted the way the cultural Christian in this country is interpreting them.
Some of us certainly discern that institutional religion in the United States in its dominant forms has got it entirely the wrong way around. You know, and I think this is just a place where we're trying to get it more right or less wrong through conversation, through experimentation, through allowing the freedom for people to have uncensored dialogue with each other.
Stages and venues for poetry, song, music, dance, and visual arts projects all encourage participants to share their personal stories in a respectful but open way.
When you have 4 days in a field and you're camping, you stop caring what you look like after a while. And when you stop caring what you look like or what you smell like, you might let your guard down just a little bit more than in everyday life and have a different kind of conversation than's possible elsewhere.
We encourage people to have conversations across different communities, and you know, Baptists and Methodists and Episcopalians and Roman Catholics, they're all a part of what this is, and we bring other voices in to speak to that conversation as well.
Speakers include authors, theologians, and business leaders. They forego all appearance fees, as do the artists and performers at Wild Goose.
There's no VIP green room, and we have people who've won Oscars and Grammys and New York Times best-selling authors. You're more likely to have a meaningful interaction with a really famous person at Wild Goose than you will at other places.
Though festival-goers may have varying backgrounds and thoughts on who or what Jesus is, workshops focus on areas of importance to a wide spectrum of people of faith: racial and social justice, diversity, immigration reform, hunger, environmental conservation, and peace.
There's a deep longing for a way of life faith.
Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove is an evangelical Christian and founding member of the New Monasticism movement.
New Monasticism is one way of describing the movement towards community, towards simplicity, and towards living nonviolently in our culture. What is church going to look like 50 years from now? I think what everybody agrees on is that something's in flux, and I think monasticism is one way that we can imagine a future together.
One important voice that will be missed in that conversation going forward, civil rights leader Vincent Harding, who died this year. As a speaker, mentor, and regular attendee, Dr. Harding, a devout Christian, was an integral part of the Wild Goose community since the inception of the festival in 2011.
I think that churches have a great opportunity and a great responsibility to find the ways to bring us together. Not just to worship, quote, together, but to live together and share our characters with each other.
We sometimes find people who are not culturally Christians and weren't raised in Christian families who follow other faiths more deeply understand the message of Jesus than sometimes we do.
The song that I'm going to sing for you is called Prayer of Light.
Singer-songwriter Ani Zonneveld is a co-founder of Muslims for Progressive Values, which advocates for issues like free speech, gender equality, and diversity.
Jesus was a revolutionary, so was Prophet Muhammad. The values of Christianity and all the three faiths are essentially is about caring for our fellow brothers and sisters. It's very simple. Music as a tool because it really touches people. The arts, music, it's the vocal, the singing voice is such a powerful tool. And I use that in a loving way to break down those barriers and to soften the heart. You have to have that security of knowing your faith for you to be so liberated, to be open-minded about something else. We are here to learn from each other, and we have different paths, but so what?
Many who've been part of it say experiences at Wild Goose can have a profound spiritual impact.
Someone connected with Wild Goose told me a story that changed my fear of death. There was a period in my life when I was completely secure. I was in a cave for about 9 months up until when I was born. So I was absolutely confident that everything was fine because I knew no alternative. And then suddenly one day, I was propelled down a tunnel. It must have felt like suffocating. It must have been absolutely terrifying. Getting born must have felt a little bit like dying. And if that's the case, then one of the stories we can tell at Wild Goose, whether you're from a Christian tradition or not, whether you're a religious person or not, is there's really no need to fear death because it's already happened to you once before and it turned out to be better than what you expected.
I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
On our calendar, for Muslims, Ramadan begins this week with the sighting of the new moon. During the month-long observance, Muslims who are able to do so fast every day from dawn to sunset and offer special prayers and gifts to the poor to become closer to God and neighbor. They often break their fast with traditional treats such as dates. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. And visit our website, where there's always much more, and where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, music from the Wild Goose Festival.
Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for what's right. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst, they shall be.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. And by these funders.